They had the best street tacos I've ever had in my whole life there.
Oh my god. No, if we're going to talk street tacos, have you been to Tijuana?
Welcome to Street Taco Cast, where all we talk about is Batman and street tacos.
Fuck you. It's talking street tacos.
Welcome to another episode of the MacGuffin Podcast, the movie review podcast that dreams are made of. Keith Foster, you live in San Diego, California.
Cassidy Robinson, you live in Las Vegas, Nevada.
And today we're going to be talking about Godzilla, King of Monsters. Is it King of Monsters or King of the Monsters?
Gojira, King of the Monsters.
Yes. And at the end of the program for the Netflix homework, we are going to discuss Alfred Hitchcock's Strangers on a Train. And we got a bunch of movie news to catch up with. It all kind of bundled up in the last couple weeks. But before we get to that, do you want to get into a little consume, a little obey?
Sure. Yeah.
We'll just jump right in to the deep end of the podcast.
I got my answers ready to go for once.
All right. This is the segment in which we talk about the media that we're currently obsessed with. Keith, what are you currently obsessed with?
DC has introduced this new streaming app, DC Universe, where they supposedly have all of their DC content, which, sidebar, isn't true. Okay, I'll talk about DC here in a minute.
Yeah, I've heard the app is up to a rough start.
Yeah, it's a hot fucking mess, and it's probably going to CISO on us soon. So, if you're interested, you might want to check out that free trial now, while it still exists. However, they are killing it in the original content game.
Oh, okay.
If they can survive long enough, and if Warner Home Media doesn't fuck them over like they have been, they could have something really cool here. I was a little skeptical because, like, the trailers for all their shows, they have three original streaming shows right now. They have Titans, based on the comic book Teen Titans, with Robin and Starfire, Raven. I haven't watched that one yet.
Wasn't that on the WB first?
No.
Oh, no. Okay. Well, I definitely saw trailers for it a long time ago.
Oh, yeah. So that's the other thing is, I'll get into DC's issues in a minute. However, I recently signed up for it solely because I was interested in the Swamp Thing series, which reports are that it is already not going to be renewed for a second season.
Yeah, that news just came out today that it's been canceled.
Yeah. I'm still hoping that maybe people rally around it because it's literally only had one episode air yet.
What?
Yeah, so they, it's annoying. They release their episodes weekly.
Yeah.
They don't just release the whole season so you can binge like Netflix. It's more like a Hulu.
How bad could it have done that they're like, nope, we're pulling the plug on this now. We're not even going to give this a three-episode try.
That's the thing. It's actually really fucking good.
Yeah.
I was a little skeptical of their TV shows because like the trailers look so-so.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes superhero TV doesn't leave it leaves you wanting more.
Sure.
However, the first episode, I was like, holy fucking shit. Like, they actually, it feels like it has a budget. It's actually shot really fucking well. It's gorgeous looking, and it's scary. It's a horror TV show that I'm like, normally horror TV, like Supernatural and stuff, the horror elements can come off really TV-ified.
Sure.
And really sort of cheesy because they can't really go there with the gore or, you know, like,
mm-hmm.
But DC Universe, since it's their own streaming app, they have no fucking content restrictions. So they're swearing, there's gratuitous violence. There's like this sequence where they're examining this body in a morgue. And I'm getting like the Thing flashbacks. Got this diseased roots inside of it, and the body like splits apart. And it's all practical, not all, but like mostly practical effects. Mm-hmm. So it looks really good. I was watching it, and I was like, holy shit, like this is a TV show? I'm very impressed.
All right.
It's so impressive that apparently the story is going around that they shot in North Carolina, and it had the first season had a budget of $80 million because they were supposedly going to get a $40 million tax break for shooting in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out the fucking accountant didn't dot the I's or something, and they're actually only getting a $14 million tax break. So they're losing like $36 million on it. So supposedly that's why it's being canceled. It has nothing to do with the quality of the show, which, okay. Like I said, I was actually really surprised at how good it was. The other show, which I've been watching, which supposedly has not been canceled yet, they haven't made any announcements anyway, is Doom Patrol. And holy fucking shit, it's so good. I was like, there is CW good, which is like, yeah, it's pretty good, you know?
Right.
And then it's like, oh, wow, they're actually like taking some really big risks here and casting some really incredible actors. Brendan Fraser plays Robot Man, and fuck, I have missed Brendan Fraser so much. He's right. Definitely gotten old and fat, but he's still fucking great. Mm-hmm. Matt Bomer is, I don't know his character's name, but they cast like one of the most attractive TV actors. And for most of the show, he has like a giant face mask on. So you can't see his face for most, like a lot of it is voice acting, which is pretty crazy. And it as Alan Tudyk plays Mr. Nobody. And it's just
like, always a delight. Really, Alan Tudyk.
Yeah, and it's really fun and charming and genuinely very funny. Mm-hmm. I am into it. So, I hope DCU gets their shit together. I hope they see how much people have been enjoying Swamp Thing and figure out some budget ways to bring it back.
Figure this out.
Yeah, I am into... Even going to check out Titans, which I thought looked like trash from the trailer, but
it didn't look great. Well, you know, I don't know if it didn't look great. It looked like a CW show is what it looked like to me, which is why I thought it
exactly.
was.
Exactly. That's what all of these shows, the trailers have looked like. I'm like, okay. Like, you know, what can they really pull off?
Yeah.
But so far I have been impressed.
Okay.
So yeah, hopefully DC gets their shit together because right now, I'm way more excited about their original TV content than any of the movies they're putting out.
It sounds cool or whatever. I don't know. I don't hear a lot of people talking about it.
It's because it's another fucking subscription service.
Right, exactly. You throw these things behind a paywall, and now there's Disney Plus coming up, which is ultimately going to be mm-hmm. Marvel Plus. And everyone's going to be subscribing to that to get their Marvel shows if they decide to renew any of the ones that were on Netflix or carry that on in any particular way. And yeah. Then, I don't know. I'm exhausted thinking about it.
Trust me, I know. And there was also a report today that AT&T and Time Warner might be releasing their own exclusive streaming app, which would gut the DCU app. I mean, it sounds like a hot mess. Hopefully, if people actually start subscribing to it, they might see that it's not failing and might actually invest in it. But I get it. It's a long shot. So that's like, honestly, you can get it for $8 a month. Check out their original content and then bail. That's my plan if they cancel all these shows. Because that's another thing is the app promised that like all of DC's entertainment would be available on this app.
Right.
But they fucking rotate their shit like Netflix does. And I'm like, you don't have enough to do rotate.
That. No.
Yeah.
Well, are they posting anything that's not original? Like, are they have contracts to like the Tim Burton Batman movies or something like that? Or
yeah. So the Tim Burton Batmans are on there. The Joel Schumacher Batmans are on there. The old Supermans are, but none of like the Nolan stuff is up there yet.
I saw you live tweeting the Joel Schumacher's Batman and Robin.
Yeah, for Comic-Con, we're cosplaying as Batman villains. Mm-hmm. So we've been, watching all the Batman movies. Mm-hmm. Batman and Robin, I think history will forgive it. It is so campy and dumb that it is actually a hell of a lot of fun. I was watching it and I was like, this is trash, but it's the kind of trash I can enjoy now.
Right.
Like, I seriously, now that especially DC is all super serious, like, I think that there's space for something to be super campy. I get that, you know, maybe Batman wasn't the best hero to do it with.
Right.
But I think it rewards going back and checking it out. It's pretty fun.
I've watched it most recently with the Kevin Smith commentary, downloadable commentary track. That was the last time I watched it. And so I don't know if that really counts as watching it per se. But I don't know. I'm not mad at it anymore like I was when I was younger. But
I think I've said this before. Part of the problem is when it came out, we weren't in like a superhero nerd culture renaissance.
Right.
We would get one superhero movie every, 4 to 5 years, and that was sort of the Batman legacy we had. We went from Tim Burton to this, and it's like, this is it? This is what we get? This was a pre-MCU, pre-Christopher Nolan, even pre-Snyderverse DC, we didn't have literally a superhero movie every other month.
Mm-hmm.
So I get why it stung back then, but now I'm like, it's actually fun. Like it is so much closer to Batman 66 than I realized.
Well, I mean, obviously that was their main reference point, was trying to capture that. And clearly, Akiva Goldsman and Joel Schumacher, that was the Batman they were the most familiar with. Even though Batman Forever is a little darker.
It feels like Batman Forever, though. It feels like he is at least trying to put his own spin on sort of the Tim Burton had
established. It's a little bit of an evolution. Yeah. It's a transitory picture between that.
Batman and Robin is its own fucking thing. Like, I didn't realize how tonally different they really were. Every fucking word out of Robin's mouth is just like, okay, Batman.
Yeah.
Oh boy. Like, no wonder it fucking killed Chris O'Donnell's career, which is a shame because,
I mean, with the exception of George Clooney, who actually was able to kind of walk away from that and reestablish a whole thing, everybody was hurt by that movie.
Uma Thurman managed to come out of it all right eventually.
Yeah. It took a while, and it only took, a Tarantino to be able to do that. But this reminds me, we're like way off on a thing now, but
that's why I wasn't going to bring Batman up.
No, I know. I was excited to bring it up, though. Writer William Bibbiani, he was a critic for Crave.com, and now he does a few different podcasts. But he wrote an article a long time ago talking about like the right ways to watch those movies.
Specifically, the Luchador theory.
Yeah, well, Forever, and then Batman and Robin. His theory is that if you look at Forever as being the context of why it's so different from the Burton movies, is because the way they decided to solve the energy crisis in Batman Returns is to turn Gotham into a Las Vegas like casino.
Yeah, and I heard something about like how it works as the same universe due to like the economic after the gangs, the Joker gangs and the circus right. gangs get
and that's
out
why
of town. One, there's like an economic boom.
Yeah.
I think it's a pretty interesting theory. Criticism. Yeah.
And then his suggestion for watching Batman and Robin is to watch it with the Spanish language on and think of it as a Luchador film instead of like a conventional superhero film.
I've seriously considered trying to adapt it as a stage musical because,
it already is.
It fucking is. I mean, it fucking is. It's a fucking musical without the songs. That's why it's so shitty. Like, fucking Uma Thurman, Poison Ivy. She gets killed in almost the exact same manner as Selena Kyle, by the way.
Yeah.
It's hilarious how much they just are like, well,
this worked in that one, that worked in that one, so we'll just a little bit of a column A, a little column B. Yeah.
Exactly. Sort of frumpy, all business girl gets killed by her boss once she discovers his...
Yeah. Which, actually, thinking about that, this is weird. The guy who plays her boss in that movie, the guy with the crazy hair, who I think she kills as soon as she comes back to life, right? She kisses him and he gets poisoned. Mm-hmm. That is the actor who did the voice of the Riddler in the animated series.
Oh, interesting. He also
it's in Gremlins
was
2.
The guy in Gremlins 2
yes.
who was basically playing a Donald Trump figure.
Pretty much. All right.
Yeah, no, he said that Donald Trump was like an influence on that figure. But what I was going to say is it's amazing because Poison Ivy gets killed, right? Mm-hmm. Killed. And then she gets sucked into the ground and basically comes out with a drag queen makeover.
Right.
And she starts talking and she has this like affectation.
Yeah.
Like this weird 1920s, like everything she says kind of has a lilt to it. Like,
yeah, what do they call the transatlantic accent?
Yeah, and no shit, we were watching it, and she comes out, and she starts, like, monologuing to herself, and she, like, takes a breath, and Ashley goes, oh, I for sure fucking thought she was about to break out in a song just now.
Right.
DC Universe is an app. In a subscription service, not so great, but they have some great original content. So if you want to check it out, now's the time before it goes belly up.
Or until the subscription is canceled and Netflix picks up the shows. You can wait till then.
We'll see. Let's see.
What was my thing again? I wanted to talk about mashups. So, you know, there's this phenomenon online of people taking two different songs and putting them together. I don't know if you've seen this before.
I'm aware.
There's this guy who I think is the king of the mashup. Like, generally speaking, I'm kind of bored of it. Like, I think by the time, like, Girl Talk got really big and everyone started playing mashups, like, unironically, I thought it was, like, not fun anymore. But there's this guy named Bill McClintock. Bill McClintock, McClintock. He does a bunch of mashups on YouTube, and they're seamless. And the one that I posted recently was of Slayer and Katrina and the Waves. Chemical Warfare, brackets, Don't It Feel Good, Walking on Sunshine. And it's pretty amazing. I don't know how he's able to isolate the tracks as well as he does, but I'm very impressed by his content. And he has a bunch of different ones like that are, you know, super crazy, but they weirdly work. So kind of on the lighter side compared to your thing, I suppose, but I really enjoyed that. I also talked about last week, the new Full of Hell record, and last weekend they were actually in town, so I went to a little show and saw them play live, and it was good. I'd never been to, you know, like a punk hardcore show in Las Vegas, and I'd heard that it's kind of violent here, so I was a little worried, but actually it was pretty chill. I would say more chill than shows I've been to in LA, and a lot more mixed, which you're going to get in a smaller city, because basically anybody who's even slightly left of center musically is going to sort of congregate, because there's just less of us. So, there's a lot more kind of mix between like metalheads and hardcore kids and punk kids, and a lot more women in the audience than I'm normally used to seeing at a hardcore show. So that was cool too.
All right.
Mixed ages and everything as well. It was also a 21 or older club, which is a little weird for that, but it worked. It was cool.
All right, cool.
They had the best street tacos I've ever had in my whole life there.
Oh, my God. No, if we're going to talk street tacos, have you been to Tijuana?
Welcome to Street Taco Cast, where all we talk about is Batman and street tacos.
Fuck you. It's talking street tacos. Or street tacon.
All right, let's get into our movie news, because we do have a bunch of it. We're going to try and do this as a speed round.
Okay, but for real, fucking Tijuana. Go to Taco Alley and go to the place that does them samurai style.
Yes.
It's literally the best tacos I've ever had in my entire
life. And then while you're there, you can get cheap antibiotics.
Yeah, you fucking can. Because fuck our healthcare system at the Mo.
Here's some movie news. I'll start us off on this one. Disney is planning a movie based on the Xbox classic Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic. Did you ever play that game? I think you did.
I did a little. I didn't have an Xbox at the time, so I only sort of played it peripherally with some friends. So Knights of the Old Republic is like...
Who's the main guy in that? Years? Is that Rendar, Mace Rendar, or something like that?
No.
How far back am I going?
You're thinking of Dash Rendar, who... what was the book called? There was a book that was like...
It was turned into a computer game, though.
No. You're so fucking wrong! Shadows of the Empire. It was a book that took place between Empire and Return of the Jedi.
Okay, so the Knights of the Old Republic was the one where
you... Knights of the Old Republic
have, like, superpowers, basically.
Takes place like... It's like a prequel thing. It's set in the Star Wars universe, but it's like 100 years before the events of the Skywalker saga or whatever.
Yes.
So it's like it's the Jedi Knights at their sort of height. I think this is the way to go for Star Wars right now. Like, you can expand the universe. It's something that will make nerds happy, because it's it's stuff they're source material they're at least peripherally with. It's still in the Star Wars universe, but it doesn't have all the baggage of having to connect with the Skywalker saga.
Yeah.
So I think this is the way to go. I'm not super into prequel stuff, and technically this is a prequel.
Yeah.
But it predates them so much that it doesn't really have to be a prequel. Like, it's just sort of a prequel of the world, not the actual story, if that makes sense.
Okay. Yeah, I still am on the belief that we need a break from Star, like a 15 to 20 year break from Star Wars before we can really appreciate it again. But we'll see what ends up here.
I do agree that maybe a little break would be nice, but clearly it's not going to happen. I mean, Disney did spend a lot of money for this, so they are going to keep pumping them out. And if they are going to keep pumping them out, I think this is the way to go. Let's do something completely new. It's not connected to anything. It's just in a world that feels familiar. So they sort of have free rein to come up with characters and stories that aren't beholden to any like direct story. So I'm for it. I think, yeah.
Okay. Next story. Mark Webb is in talks to direct Disney's, I guess, live-action remake of Snow White, Mark Webb being the director of 500 Days of Summer and the Amazing Spider-Man movies.
Sure.
Whatever.
I mean, yeah. I'm not going to be excited about any of these live-action remakes. Don't care. I mean, the only thing I will say is Snow White as a movie is pretty dated.
Yeah.
So... of all of them, I guess this one makes sense. It's just that, you know, we're so far into these live-action remakes that I just...
But they're not going to do anything cool. They're just going to color inside the lines like they always do. And that's not like they're going to, like, go, like... Like, I think there's a version of a Snow White movie you could go back to, like, the Grimm's Fairy Tale version of it. And we've seen that before on TV, like...
HBO Snow White, A Tale of Terror. Yeah,
yes. I remember. I've yes.
brought it up before.
you know, so that would be...
Sigourney Weaves?
Yeah, I was... Yes, that one as well. And so you could do something kind of cool with that and kind of, you know, make it darker, make it more like a witch movie.
I mean, they're not going to make it super dark,
no,
but...
Or you could... You could even do a Disneyized version of. I don't care. I'm bored talking about this already. Mark Webb is also kind of a hack director, as far as I'm concerned. I didn't really like his Spider-Man movies. 500 Days of Summer was nice, but you know it was what it was in 2000 whatever.
Yeah, it's like sort of the safest choice for the safest choice.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't give me a lot of confidence. All right.
It'll probably be better than Snow White and the Huntsman, though. That was trash.
I'm going to say it's going to be about as good. Probably a lateral move as far as that goes.
I don't see how that's possible. Those movies were so bad. But anyway.
At least you had Charlize Theron, you know, swallowing up the whole thing. DC film adaptation of Jack Kirby's The New Gods will be written by comic book writer Tom King. Now, this is on Geek Tyrant. This is a story you posted. Is this for film, or is this TV, or what?
This is film, yeah. So, Ava DuVernay's directing. She's been slated as the director
for a long time, right? I remember talking about this.
So, it sort of surprises me that they didn't already have a writer or a script or anything before signing her, but whatever. Yes. So, Tom King... Oh, man, Tom King has been in the news a lot. He's sort of
rising...
It's complicated, the legacy of Tom King. So he a couple years ago, he started writing Mr. Miracle, which Mr. Miracle is based on one of the new gods of the DC universe. These characters were originally created by Jack Kirby, back in sort of the golden age and silver age of comics. Yeah,
this is where Darkseid and Steppenwolf and all these people were created.
Yeah, and Orion and all these characters that sort of became the cosmic side of the DC universe. So he wrote this really fucking good story called Mr. Miracle, and it was all about this one new god named Mr. Miracle. And it's so fucking good. It makes me very excited that he is brought on to do a New Gods adaptation. My only hesitation is the fact that it is DC and it is Warner Brothers, so I'm afraid it's just the script is going to get churned through their fucking studio machine.
Well, they want their Infinity War, Keith. That's what this is about, is they want to get big, they want to get grandiose, they want to go into space.
I know, and Mr. Miracle... is that, but it's also the opposite of that. It's you get the big and the grandiose through the lens of a character who is like going through some serious mental health issues. So it's and also is like living a normal life on Earth. Uh-huh. And it's such a good book, regardless of whether or not the movie's going to be good, everyone should go read Mr. Miracle.
Okay.
It's one of the best DC comics I've read in a long time. Yeah, so I am afraid that it is going to get too overblown. And he is a strange pull if that's what they're going for, because he is sort of he does really postmodern takes with superheroes. To the point where people like
Kirby or the Tom King guy?
Tom King. Kirby is long long been dead.
Right, right, right.
But Tom King was sort of a rising star with DC. He's been writing Batman for a while, but he just got fired from Batman, and they don't know. There's rumors that it's because he's doing this movie now. There's other rumors that it's because he's been ruffling too many feathers with DC. Like, you can't do this with Batman, but he'll do that with Batman. So I have a feeling he's going to turn in a really cool script.
That will get rejected outright.
I hope it doesn't. I hope Ava DuVernay works with him and they see... I'm not going to say I'm cautiously optimistic, because I really think that Warner Brothers is going, like, they just don't know what the fuck they're doing when it comes to comic book movies. They've shown us time and time again. They don't know what they have. However,
well, they got a lot coming up. So they got the new Wonder Woman movie. There's the Joker movie that's coming out here later in the year. So maybe they're going to, you know, kind of, and Shazam was decent. So maybe they're kind of trying to find new footing or reestablish themselves.
Hopefully. I'm excited for the potential. That's what I'll say. I'm not cautiously optimistic. I'm excited for the potential.
Sure.
Which means that when it fails, it will be that much more heartbreaking.
All right. Quentin Tarantino is going to produce a Django Zorro film that's being, co-written by Gerard Carmichael. The comedian.
Yeah, I'm into this. Django was a character before Tarantino did an adaptation of Django. He was sort of like a pulpy
kind of like Zorro.
Yeah, so
or like Zatoichi, or like
attribute Yojimbo. It even more to like Yojimbo.
Right.
So it's like sort of this character that nobody has any direct ownership of.
Yes.
Yeah, I think this could be a lot of fun. I'm into it. And I'm actually glad that Tarantino's not writing and directing it, so it could kind of has a chance to be its own thing.
Gerard Carmichael's an interesting guy, interesting comedian. He's, have you ever watched his stand-up?
Did you watch his HBO special?
No, I heard it was good, though.
Yes. It's different. It was directed by Bo Burnham.
Okay.
And so most of it's
like him in his house, cool. like having these real conversations with his family, right? Or are those interstitial between the stand-up?
No, at least the one I have seen. I think you're thinking of a different comic. There's a comic who did his set that wasn't live, and that wasn't Gerard Carmichael. At least not the one I'm thinking of. His special for HBO, it starts in the middle of a joke. It's it's pretty cool. And like most of it is like super close up on him.
Yeah.
And then just sort of crowd shots. It's definitely shot very different than your average stand up special. And he's right. Funny too. Like,
I think he's very funny. And we are talking about the same guy. I think we just might be talking about two different things that he did for HBO. But
yeah, maybe. Maybe I haven't seen the one you're talking about.
But yeah, he's kind of he's a younger comedian, I suppose, and he has jokes that if you were to just read them on paper would seem like super edgelord, like trying too hard to be edgy kind of thing, but it's his delivery.
I think that's a lot of comedians.
But his delivery is so like calm and so like matter of fact that it doesn't come off that way. Like he never seems like it's coming from a mean-spirited place.
I would describe him as dry.
Yes, very, very much so. And also kind of cool in a way. So I'm interested in like what he has a very distinct voice when it comes to writing.
I actually think that his voice makes a lot of sense with Tarantino. I actually think these two could make a really cool pairing, and yeah, and I liked Django, and I hope they can bring Jamie Foxx back. Like, I think that would be interesting to see this character sort of live on.
Yeah, outside of the Tarantino verse. Yeah, I think that would be cool. And I would be really interested to see like a reinterpretation of Zorro as well. I was not the biggest Django fan. I mean, I like it in the sense that you know, with a Tarantino film, you're not going to dislike everything you see. But it's definitely my least favorite thing he's ever done. But
interesting. I need to see it again because I only saw it the once in theaters, and my theater going experience was so bad that I think that kind of tainted the movie.
Kind of ruined it.
I remember enjoying the movie, but yeah, I was just like so frustrated with all of my surroundings. Yeah. But yeah, I agree. Like I think it's a really interesting movie to make. Like so regardless of whether or not I think it's a cool experiment.
Yes. Yes, I'm down. All right. Let's go ahead and start talking about Godzilla, King of the Monsters. And Keith, why don't you describe to me what's going on in this movie?
Okay. I'll do my best. So this is a direct sequel to the Godzilla American reboot, I don't even know if a reboot's the right word.
Legendary's Godzilla from 2014, directed by Gareth Edwards. Yes.
Yeah. This time we have Michael Dougherty directing.
Yes.
Who most people probably know from Krampus.
Mm-hmm. And Trick or Treat.
Yeah, yeah. So after the fight between Godzilla and the Bug Monsters of 2014, various government agencies are vying for ways to control these giant monsters that they call Titans. Vera Farmiga's character, who is the mother of Millie Bobby Brown's character. Here's the thing. I'm going to be referencing the actors because none of these character names matter.
No.
Vera Farmiga has figured out a way to possibly control these Titans.
Yes. And communicate with them via sonar.
Yeah. Kyle Chandler plays Millie Bobby Brown's absent father. So there's this government agency that's like, we're cool with the Titans, called Monarch. And they're like, we want to live in peace with them and coexistence. And then out of nowhere comes fucking, what's his name from Game of Thrones?
Charles Dance. Yeah.
Ah, fucking Charles Dance. If Charles Dance.
He's Charles Dancing all over this movie.
If he was 20 years younger, he would be the perfect Doctor Doom, by the way.
Okay, yeah, that's an interesting take.
No, he would be. Yeah, he'd be so good.
Yeah.
He comes in and he's sort of this eco terrorist group that wants to unleash all the Titans, to let them wipe out humanity and restore balance, blah blah blah, very Thanos-y.
Yeah.
Through the course of events, they start waking up these Titans, and they wake up Ghidorah. A three-headed dragon who might be an alien?
It's in the air.
Is Godzilla's alpha rival, so they have to reawaken Godzilla to do battle, to take his rightful place as King of the Monsters.
Yes, we also see a little bit of Rodan, we also see a little bit of Mothra, and there's some other ones.
We also see the elephant
thing that we don't know what it is.
Baphomet?
Yes.
I believe is his name. They reference Kong a couple times.
Mm-hmm. They're pretty heavy-handed on setting up this monster universe.
Yeah.
And the next film that I believe is supposed to be coming out and that's already been shot is King Kong versus Godzilla, which would be a remake. But so is this, actually. There was a film from the 50s or 60s titled something very similar to Godzilla King of the Monsters, in which he fights all these guys.
I think it was, I believe it. The English translation was Godzilla King of Monsters.
Yes.
Yeah, and in that, they go to Monster Island, and Godzilla battles. It's a very similar plot. You know, he battles, close adaptation, actually.
Was there all the stuff about, eco-terrorism and sonar that stuff? And divorcing? Broken families.
Yeah, so let's talk about this. let's talk about this movie.
Yes.
All of that is new and mostly dumb and bad. And I needed
about 40% less of it.
Yeah, and about 60% more monsters fighting.
Yes.
Now, I do feel like we get a little bit more monster action than we got in the previous Godzilla movie. However, a lot of it is very obscured by sort of rain or debris or smoke or whatever it is.
It's
the same thing as the Transformers movies, where for some reason there's this mentality in Hollywood, in big budget blockbuster productions, of like, we have to ground this. We have to have human stories to follow, which I'm going to say is kind of bullshit. I call it the stupid human crap. Yeah. I don't care about the stupid human crap. I just want to see the monsters fighting.
Yes.
In general, I was pretty satisfied with the monsters fighting.
Mm-hmm.
But I was getting frustrated when, especially during the climax, I just want to see Godzilla throwing down with King Ghidorah, and all of a sudden the helicopter's almost falling on Kyle Chandler, and Vera Farmiga's talking about family.
And we got to find our Millie daughter. Bobby. Where'd she go? Oh, she went back to our home because she wants us to be together. And
Here's the thing. If you work in Hollywood and you happen to be listening to this right now, nobody cares.
No.
Nobody wants that.
Well, not only does nobody want any of that in this movie. It's a complete waste of these three actors who are very good in other films.
I knew that would be happening.
In a better film, in a remake of Kramer versus Kramer, without the monsters, that family would have been great. But
I'm calling kind of bullshit on that. Like, this, if nothing else, Legendary has established that this is the cinematic universe where they get amazing actors to deliver shit dialogue for a couple scenes and then die.
Well, right, but why? Like, what's, I mean...
Because they're amazing actors and they'll hopefully draw people to the movie theater? I don't know.
No, we saw the same thing. You could put anybody in those roles and the film is going to draw what it's going. No one's going to this movie to see Vera Farmiga and Kyle Chandler. They're going to see Ghidorah versus Godzilla. They're going to see
Mothra. They just need as good of actors as they can to deliver their shit dialogue. Here's the thing. I don't care. I don't care about any of that. It sort of comes down to the same thing with Kong Skull Island. Was like, yeah, sure, they waste Brie Larson and Tom Hiddleston, and the more egregious sin, John Goodman, who doesn't do as many movies nowadays.
No.
And so when I see him, I want something.
But you know what?
You know,
I'll say this about Kong Skull Island. I think that
the
movie,
John C. Reilly factor.
Well, there was that, but also I think that movie, the structure of it, justified human characters more than this one did. Like, this is basically a disaster film. Like, a very, 1998-style disaster film. Just replace Earthquake or Meteor or whatever with these monsters. It's just really an excuse for giant destruction scenes. And which isn't the appeal of these monsters. Yes, you want buildings for them to topple over, but you really want to see them kind of like in full frame fighting. And we get a little bit of that, but not nearly enough.
No. And I will say this about comparing it to Kong Skull Island is Kong Skull Island knew exactly what type of movie it was.
Right, that
it
movie
is a
like
schlocky monster flick, but you get the goods.
You get monsters.
Yeah.
And you get them here, too.
You do. And again, I do think it's a better... I was a lot more satisfied with this than I was the 2014 Godzilla, which you hated a lot more than I did.
I don't know. They're kind of six in one, half a dozen the other, because I don't like either. But I don't really like either film for slightly different reasons.
Yeah, I guess. I didn't hate this movie, but I didn't love it, and I wanted to love it. I thought the trailer did everything right. The trailer showed all of the stuff that I wanted to see, and then...
Literally all of it.
And then that was it.
Literally all of it is in the trailer. Like, if anything you want to see out of this movie that involves these monsters battling is in the trailer. Everything else, what you're coming for, is Kyle Chandler and Vera Farmiga and Millie Bobby Brown running around talking about divorce and eco-terrorism.
That being said, I could not help but really enjoy the Rodan sequence in particular stood out to me.
Yeah, that was a good one where he comes out of the volcano.
The volcano. Yeah, fucking cool.
Yeah, that was cool. I also really like it. I maybe that's kind of part of the same sequence where Ghidorah comes and kind of lands on the top of the volcano and sort of like calls out to all of the other Titans that he is now the king of the Titans. I mean, that and then...
Yeah, that was that whole sequence.
In individual shots of the movie are, you know, pretty metal, but...
I also really enjoyed the fight sequence between Mothra and Rodan. And in the story itself, the Godzilla stuff, I actually really liked, like... the crazy oxygen bomb and the fucking tunnels underneath the earth and
yeah,
this movie goes into some crazy conspiracy theory territory. Like the Hollow Earth is a genuine conspiracy theory that I never expected to see in a big budget movie. Right. So there was enough stuff like that kept sucking me back in despite the shitty melodrama of the stupid human
crap. Right, which is why I think that it makes up some of its deficit in just pure pulp goofiness.
Yeah.
But it doesn't feel, to me, it doesn't, like, again, comparing to Skull Island, which I think is so far the best that this universe has to offer.
Yeah, I think I agree so far.
That movie sort of embraces pulp in a way that sort of connects it back to the original King Kong movie or the original Godzilla films or even like the Harryhausen kind of movies. That movie like totally understands the genre conventions. This movie, yes, like I said, reminded me a lot more of a bad 90s disaster film where it's just making up a bunch of sci-fi nonsense to get itself out of these corners that the script writes itself in. So it doesn't feel, when it gets goofy, it doesn't feel intentional and it doesn't feel connected to genre. It just feels like bad, lazy writing.
Yes, I do agree with you that I think that this movie didn't understand sort of the tone that it should have been.
No, which is weird considering the director, who obviously is like enjoys the king pulp
of horror genre, right? Or of horror camp right now.
But who knows, like, you know, what he was allowed to do or, you know, how constrained he was by the studio or, you know, how big this project apparatus was around him. Like, he might have just been there to, you know, tell the cameraman where to go.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. And here's the thing. I get that this is a flawed movie, and I think that there's a half hour shorter cut that is probably pretty fun. But all, like I said, I couldn't help but enjoy it despite all of its obvious failings. And this isn't a good defense of the movie.
Yeah.
But Godzilla movies aren't good. And that's sort of the problem this movie has, is it's trying to be good, and it's not. And I wish they had leaned into that camp, but they didn't. And I still had... I wish the movie was as self-aware as the marketing was.
Yes.
But I still couldn't help but enjoy it. Like, when Godzilla fucking shoots his fucking fire breath and does his scream, and, you know, I saw it in IMAX, so these monsters were as big as they're gonna get.
Yeah.
There's something that is so primal and powerful about that allows me to enjoy the movie despite how not good it is.
The scale and the special effects and all of that stuff pretty much works, which is why it feels all the more like a waste that the movie doesn't utilize it more than they do.
Definitely.
I enjoy bits and pieces of the movie, but I don't think that there's enough there holding it together. And I would argue, actually, that the first Godzilla film from whatever it is, 1950.
2014?
No, no, no. The original Gojira.
The 90s?
No, from the...
Oh, the original, the original.
Yeah, the original, from the 50s.
The
Japanese first Godzilla film is a legitimately good film. Yes. I mean, it is a kind of a B movie in a way, but I think it, you know, that's saying a lot about like Japan post nuclear Holocaust and all of that stuff.
That movie is
a little bit smarter than people might remember it being. Yes,
and it is a little bit before its time.
Yes, before its time as well, and it kind of birthed like, you know, films like Akira and whatever. But this movie, I'm gonna have to say, is mostly bad. It might be fun bad sometimes. But that's the best I can say about it. I found it mostly to be kind of a headache, and I like the monster stuff, but like I said, you can get all that from the trailer.
I think you're being a little bit of a grump on this one. I think there's not necessarily anything wrong with a middle of the road disaster monster flick like this movie.
I don't either. I don't think this is middle of the road. I think this is way off the road.
To me, this movie feels like
Kong Skull Island.
To me, this movie feels sort of like, other than the special effects, this feels like it should have come out in like 1998.
Yes,
I don't necessarily have a problem with that. Like, I look back on like Independence Day and stuff with some pretty fond memories. So
yeah,
I'm a little bit more forgiving of this.
Some of the disaster films from that era were better than others. Independence Day, I would say, would be up there. So would Twister. And those are movies that were poorly reviewed at the time.
Okay. Yeah, but like the script is also pretty goofy. Like they go up and...
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Now you're... Now, don't defend your nostalgia.
I'm not. I think this movie, for just judging from the quality of the era of which it comes, is as good on the same tier as Godzilla 98. I think it's as bad and occasionally as funny or good or entertaining as the Roland Emmerich Godzilla film. So... whatever that means to you.
You know what? I don't think that the Roland Emmerich film is necessarily the worst. I think the worst thing about that movie is the fact that it wants to be Jurassic Park so fucking bad.
True.
And it's hilarious to me that Lost World wanted to be Godzilla so fucking bad that those directors really should have switched projects. But
probably.
I actually caught the 98 Godzilla at a bar not too long ago.
Yeah.
And I was having fun with it. I mean, it's not good. It is cheesy and schmaltzy. But there's some fun stuff. So, I don't know. I think this movie's pretty forgivable. It's not great, but don't go expecting a good fucking movie. All right.
I don't know what kind of review that is. Put that on the poster. Don't go expecting a good fucking movie.
Yes, please. Know what you're getting into. What's your letter grade?
Oh, God. I'm like struggling between a D+ and a C-.
You're such a fucking grump ass.
I'm going to give it a D+ because a C, I think, is like a little bit more of a yellow tomato. This is more of a splat for me.
So realistically, I would probably just give this a straight C.
Yeah.
But grading a little bit on a curve, I'm going to give it a B-.
You are high.
It gets the giant monster
curve. What's the curve?
Anything with giant monsters, I'm going to like a little bit more. Like... it's a mathematical equation that a giant monster will make me like a movie more. I watched Pacific Rim Uprising. That movie is fucking trash. That movie's garbage.
Okay.
But I still had a little bit of fun with it.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know. What is the worst version of this? Because this is as bad as it's been for a while for me.
Pacific Rim Uprising is terrible.
Okay, and I didn't see that movie.
But I still had... that movie is a D+.
Yeah.
But grading on a curve, I gave it like a C.
Just for the monster factor. So Wow, on that curve alone, I mean, maybe I have to go back and listen to our...
No, I'm telling you, man, it marks it up like a grade and a half.
I know, I have to go back and listen to our Kong Skull Island, because you already stated that any movie with John C. Reilly is automatically better.
That's John C. Reilly. That movie has a double fucking curve.
Yeah, so what is that, like an A plus for you? I don't remember.
I think I gave it a B plus.
All right.
I agree. That had John C. Reilly not been in that movie, I think I would have felt about the same as I did about this.
I like the stuff with Ghidorah. I'll give you that. Okay, so let's go ahead and move on to the Netflix homework. And we're going to be discussing Strangers on a Train, the classic from Alfred Hitchcock. Okay, so Strangers on a Train was released in 1951, and it is a murder mystery, dark comedic noir about two men who meet on a train, one played by Robert Walker, the other one played by Farley Granger, Guy Haines and Bruno Anthony. They are having a conversation on the train, and Bruno seems to know a lot about Guy. Guy is a famous, semi-famous tennis player. And he's had some marriage troubles, and he's in the middle of a messy divorce. And Bruno knows this and proposes the idea that, you know, we all have people in our lives that we want to get rid of. And, you know, maybe in a super hypothetical, it'd kind of be cool if they switched motives, switched murders, and Bruno would take out Guy's ex-wife, and Guy would take out Bruno's disapproving father. Bruno carries on with this plan unbeknownst to Guy and pulls Guy into a paranoid mess of can't go to the police, can't take care of this on his own, doesn't really want him to kill somebody, but maybe he has to now. So what did you think of Strangers on a Train?
I'm still sort of summing up what I thought about this movie, because I think the setup is really good. The premise is really cool.
Mm-hmm.
I think from the beginning, I was like, oh shit, I'm in. I think that this movie is kind of, dated.
I don't know what you mean by that. I mean, it's made 1950. So in that sense, yes,
I think it's kind of dated in the way this movie thinks crime works. and obviously, you know, we're in a very different era of true crime,
right?
You know, where back then there weren't the same type of forensics and stuff.
Yeah.
But sort of the logical leaps that they go to, this movie has to go to sort of convolute Guy's guilt and. There was some stuff that I thought was pretty fucking silly in a way that I normally don't feel from a Hitchcock. Like, I think a lot of Hitchcock dates pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
But this, once, I mean, there's a fucking tennis match that is supposed to be like the climax of this movie, and then the carousel scene, like, there's some goofy shit in here.
I actually think the carousel scene, the one at the end in particular,
oh my god,
is
no.
Yeah, I actually think that that's like a one of the earliest like action, like genuine like sort of action scenes in a movie, like,
okay, that's, sure, but that's what I'm talking about when I say it dates, like it's a fucking carousel gets turned to max speed, mm-hmm. and becomes deadly fast.
Yeah.
And it's just like pretty goofy. Now, I mean, that being said, like, I still enjoyed this movie. I just don't think it holds up as well as a lot of other Hitchcock stuff does. I think once it gets sort of bogged down in the plot of it, in the story of it, it gets kind of convoluted. Like, there's this whole portion where it's like, Wait, what with the lighter? Like, his plan is to go back to the island and drop it at the crime scene. Mm-hmm. Like, why wouldn't he just take it to the police? Like, his plan doesn't make any sense at a certain point of time. What I think works is the characters.
Yes.
And their relationships to each other. Robert Walker is fucking great as this, like, seemingly normal guy that once you get to know him, you're like, oh, he's fucking cuckoo.
Right. There's one scene in particular where, like, again, mm-hmm. yeah, you see him on the train, you see him talk to different people, and he seems, like, weird for sure. And,
yeah.
And,
but you don't, he seems a little off and
but maybe in a way that's like
familiar.
Right. In a way that, like, kind of makes sense. But then there's a scene where he like talks to guy's senator father about like flowers on Mars or something, and you realize like, yeah. Oh, this guy's fucking crazy.
Yeah, exactly. Like with a capital Z.
Yes.
Yeah, so all of the character stuff I really liked, and I think this movie pulled off really well. And I think the guy, probably Granger, did a pretty good job as, like, you know, sort of this sort of noirish character who, you know, yeah. is in a tight spot. Like the detail about the sister-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
Looking like his, you know, his murdered wife, I thought was really cool. Like, there's stuff that I felt like really worked.
Mm-hmm.
It's just once it got bogged down in all the details of like how he's gonna frame him and stuff. I'm like, it was sort of Occam's razor. Like, there's an easier setup here, and it felt like the movie was sort of convoluting things in ways that I thought was very strange.
Right.
And I just sort of chalked that up to the way, you know, police procedural stuff was sort of interpreted at the time.
That's a possibility. Now, I don't know if you mentioned earlier that this was co-written by Raymond Chandler. Mm-hmm. Raymond Chandler... And this is based on a book, actually, by Patricia Highsmith, who I want to say, didn't she also write... Yes, she wrote the novels for which The Talented Mr. Ripley and the movie Carol were based on.
Oh, right.
But yes, I chalk all of this kind of convolution, plot convolution stuff, mostly to Raymond Chandler. 'Cause if you think of like a Chandler-esque detective story, something like
mm-hmm.
You know, Murder My Sweet or The Big Sleep or whatever, there's always like 1,000 characters to meet and all of these red herrings and everything, like all these different motives that kind of get stacked up on each other, and then by the end of the movie, in the last like third, you realize like, oh, most of that didn't matter. Like, that was all just there to kind of pad things out or to kind of throw you off. And what it always comes down to with Chandler is the characters, and also Hitchcock, I would say as well. I mean, his, you know, some of his movies are a little bit more plot driven than others. I think this one is first and foremost a character driven thing. And I'm not sure if.
Yeah. And I think all of that stuff plays really well. It's just when the plot sort of takes the driver's seat, I start to get a little bored, and it starts to feel a lot more 50s.
Well, what I think
that being said,
okay, go ahead.
That being said, there's some great stuff in this too. Like the murder sequence,
mm-hmm.
The initial murder scene is pretty fucking chilling, actually. Like, I thought that held up really well.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's sort of a mixed bag for me. Like, I think some of this movie dates pretty poorly, but then other parts of it are like pretty harrowing.
Mm-hmm. I think that the stuff that makes up for some of the silly, more pulpy plot stuff, specifically, I mean, yes, the characters and the acting and sort of the dialogue, I'm all in for. And I think there is a dark humor aspect to this movie. I don't mm-hmm. think it's just watching it from a, you know, a 2019 critical eye that kind of like transforms some of this into camp. I think Hitchcock has always kind of had a dark sense of humor, even in his you know, most dark, his darkest, most murderous movies like Psycho or something. There's a lot of funny stuff in Psycho too. I think there's, you know, specific, I think he's having playful fun in all of this. And there's, you know, there's some great pieces of dialogue where they're talking about like, oh, where the one sister-in-law says, oh, I was just speaking to police, to this police officer here who caught the mass murderer last month. He, you know, what did he say? He was stuck in a refrigerator with somebody's leg for overnight, something like that. And,
yeah.
And so, you know, Hitchcock has his kind of dark humor stuff that he likes to do. And I think that's a lot of fun. But I think even during those sequences, and you mentioned the murder sequence itself, is that's a good example. Also, I think later when in between the tennis match, when we see Bruno kind of making his way back to the island, I think there's really good Hitchcockian perspective stuff where,
I mean, yeah,
you know, we're just following the character with the camera and
the whole tennis match thing was so dumb though. Like, yeah, I got that he had to do this tennis match so that he wouldn't look guilty. But like, why could, like, it gets to the point where he tries to win really quickly and then, he almost does, and then it becomes a really competitive game. Like, at a certain point, logically, wouldn't he just be like, okay, well, I guess I'm just going to lose this match so I can, you know, deal with the fucking murder thing?
Yeah.
I don't know. There was just some stuff that I was like, I really liked the first two-thirds of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
But the climax for me got real silly.
Okay, yeah, I could use a little bit of less tennis in this. I'll say that. I think that scene drags a little bit. I enjoy this movie. This isn't like top tier Hitchcock for me, but I think it's right there, you know, with some of his more watchable material. And specifically, I like it for the performances of the two leads. I think they're really engaging together.
And again, I love the premise of it. I love that. This fucking weirdo is just like, hey, you know, if I murder this person for you, will you murder my dad? What? No. Okay. Well, I'm just going to do it. And then you have to.
Right.
He's so good in it. Like, excuse me. Like, I would say, yeah, it's definitely worth watching just for that story alone. And, and just for Robert Walker's performance alone, it's worth it.
Mm-hmm.
He is fun and charming, but at the same time, like, terrifying.
Yeah, super weirdo. Yeah. And I really like a lot of the side characters as well. All these, like, that's one of the things you get from great Hitchcock films is even the third string, you know, tertiary characters are super memorable and get a lot to do. And they're a lot of fun. I think we've seen, obviously, like movies like Throw Mama from the Train, which directly references this film, but also movies like Horrible Bosses. It's interesting how this movie, like, it's kind of influenced dark comedy almost even more than thrillers. But we,
you know, I didn't really think about it till you mention it, but
yeah,
but I was actually thinking that, I mean, this is the type of movie that I think would be rife for a remake. I mean, maybe don't try to do it like they did with the fucking Vince Vaughn Psycho, but I think that this type of story you could update pretty easily.
Right, and I think in some ways we've seen that. Even Woody Allen's Match Point, if you want to talk about another tennis-themed thriller, has a lot of parallels to this as well, both stylistically and in some of the plot stuff. So, yeah, I recommend it. Keith, I guess a little bit less so. Would you have liked it more if there were monsters in John C. Reilly?
I mean, yeah. I here's the thing. I will recommend it if you are familiar with Hitchcock and you like Hitchcock or you like movies of this time. I think as far as like the characters and dialogue stuff goes, it doesn't date as bad as a lot of movies from this era. However, I don't know. I would recommend it. I just think it, you know, it gets pretty silly at the end.
Sure.
And it sort of bummed me out because I think that there was a lot. I wouldn't even say bummed me out. I had a lot of fun with this movie. I just think that some of the tension started to fall apart a little bit for me, and that is something that you know, Hitchcock is so renowned for is that tension.
Mm-hmm.
But again, there's great stuff in here. I mean, the murder sequence alone is worth your time.
What do you want to assign for me next week?
Next week, we're going to watch the Daniel Radcliffe quirky indie oddball movie Swiss Army Man from a couple years back.
Yes. Cool. Well, if anybody has anything to say about anything we talked about in this podcast or others before it, you can get in contact with us at our email at MacGuffinPod@gmail.com. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at MacGuffinPod and on Facebook at Facebook.com/MacGuffinPod. You can also contact me individually on Twitter at VC Cassidy. You can see the movie reviews that I've written for the Idaho State Journal at the IdahoStateJournal.com/arts and entertainment section. You can also see some of the stuff I've written for The MacGuffin over at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. And while you're there, be sure to read the other authors and staff contributors and some of the other stuff they're doing. You can also find and stream this podcast at iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Pocket Cast, and Player.fm. Keith, what are your things?
You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Keith Foster Kid. Go to my website, www.keithfosterkid.com.
All right, and check out our other friends out there who are doing podcasts of their own, including Buddy and Alice over at Those Happy Places. They just went to Disneyland and checked out the new Star Wars stuff, so I'm sure they got an episode cooking on that.
Ooh.
And I think, check out their other podcast, speaking of Star Wars, Rogue Fun, a Star Wars podcast, and also be sure to listen to Bill and Brian over at the Great Albums podcast. They have a couple more left coming out in the month. And Patrick and Dennis over at Almost Educational, and Mike Falick over at Hack Thought.
All right.
And with that,
this is Godzilla's World, and we just live in it.